Street Dance. Susan stood across the square, just outside the orbit of people who were visiting the booths and attractions. Her parents had talked her into coming home for this goofy festival, where apparently everyone was excited about a damn helicopter visiting the town, giving rides and prizes. It all seemed so hokey to Susan. 6 months ago, Shorter, Missouri was the only place, really the only universe, Susan had ever known. She was sure she had walked every sidewalk, knew every tree root, what every store and house and person smelled like. Coming back this weekend was like putting on the clothes you had worn on the last day of high school, but no one had bothered to wash them. Susan had started at University of Missouri in January, carefully accumulating sufficient credits and test scores to graduate high school at the end of December semester. This had been her plan since she was 15 and a freshman. Now, she was a freshman again. But not here. Not at Shorter High School. Not in Shorter, Missouri. Though Columbia was less than 2 hours, less than 100 miles away, Susan lived in a different world now, and glad of it. This was only her second time home since January. She had planned to come home in late May to participate in the graduation ceremony, but had gotten sick a few days before and stayed in Columbia, missing the milestone. Her parents, Ed and Emma Jean, had been sad and disappointed that she had not attended her graduation, had not walked across that stage. Her mother even dropped a hint that she thought Susan might be faking it. But they had cheered when her name was read, they had told her. Susan felt a deep embarrassment hearing that, even though she wasn't even there. Her parents' feelings and attitudes about her early non-graduation were mixed and uneven. They were encouraging and proud of how hard Susan worked in high school, and glad that she had set her focus so piercingly on college. She would be the first in her family to attend MU, and, hopefully, to graduate with a degree. But they couldn't understand why she was in such a hurry to end one chapter, start the next. This was going to cost her parents some real money. Her father's job, well, one of his several jobs, but his main one, was running a contract newspaper delivery route for the Kansas City Star, nearly 400 customers. It was steady and dependable, but hardly making a fortune. So, here she was, back in Shorter, feeling like she'd never left, and also like she'd never lived here, an uncomfortable in-between. Susan watched the crowd, the young, the old. She saw people around her own age, knew almost all of them, and the ones she didn't know, she could guess their story. It was easy to spot the ones who were from the other small towns, a dozen or so miles this way or that way. She could even guess which towns they belonged to. Susan saw a girl cutting quickly through the crowd who was definitely from someplace else, some other planet and universe entirely. She was about Susan's age, but her hair was inky black and piled high on her head like an old-time country singer, stiff as a helmet with two long ringlets coming down in front of each gold-hooped ear. She had two cigarettes, one tucked above each ear, short antenna of a dangerous exotic insect. She wore a black sleeveless top with bra straps showing, red frayed cut-off shorts, longer than most girls were wearing them. Susan watched her with confused interest. Was she cool, or was she just strange? Was she poor and trashy, clueless? Or was she brave and independent and truly didn't give a shit what people thought of how she looked? Susan received an answer, of sorts, when the girl cut across the recently assembled carnival rides, stepping over cables and stakes and ropes without looking. She pulled down a hidden folding step on the side of a small trailer and disappeared through an odd oval door. The girl was carnival. That explained a lot. And nothing at all. The trailer was small. Too small to be a living quarters, Susan thought. It had a large hinged panel on the front that likely covered serving windows. The word concessions painted in red letters above and below the hinged panel. As if by will or wish or just lucky timing, Susan watched the hinged panel slowly raise into position, a steady crank apparatus somewhere, stopping perpendicular to the trailer front, forming a shade roof over the serving windows. Susan could see movement inside, items being placed on a small front counter, an electric fan hooked on a nail and powered up. The black-haired girl leaned her elbows on the counter and brought her face, eyes closed and chin raised, up to the blowing fan. She slowly rotated her face back and forth in the cooling air, her hair not moving except for the ringlets by her ears. She suddenly opened her eyes and turned, looking across the span of the town square directly to where Susan was standing, making eye contact. She held it for a couple seconds, then went back to her preparations, taking one of the cigarettes from behind her ear and lighting it up. Susan casually worked her way toward the concession booth. There was an older woman inside, along with the girl. The woman was pouring this jug and that jug into different machines and dispensers, while the girl wiped down surfaces with a rag, flipping her cigarette ashes out the open window. She glanced up at Susan, then went back to her work. Susan approached the window, looking off in different directions as she approached.
"We're not open yet,"
the girl said, without looking up.
"Good,"
Susan replied. The girl looked over sharply, squinting at the unexpected answer.
"Can I bum a smoke?"
Susan asked.
The girl held a second, then answered, "I'm all out."
Susan raised her eyebrows, then a slow index finger, pointing to her own right ear, which mirrored the girl's left ear where the other cigarette was in plain sight. The girl frowned, her eyes going up and over like she might be able to see what Susan was mirror pointing at. There was a smile.
"Oh, yeah,"
she said.
"So when did you start smoking, Susie?"
the dark-haired girl asked.
"What? How do you know my name?"
"Huh? So it really is Susie?"
and the girl laughed.
"I just figured you looked like every Susie in every town before and all the ones coming up."
She looked Susan up and down, then took the cigarette from behind her ear, reaching out long to hand it to Susan.
"So, I take it you live here?"
"Well, yes and no," Susan said. "I'm actually in college at MU, studying architecture."
She knew that sounded pretentious soon as the words left her mouth.
"Architecture, really?"
the girl said with comic drawl.
"At good old Columbia. I always have a good time in that town. So, who's your favorite?"
"Who's my favorite what?"
Susan asked, thinking the girl must mean football team or bar or band.
"Architect. Who's your favorite architect?"
Susan looked away, scanning the flat fronts of the red brick buildings edging the town square, trying to remember some of the names she had skimmed over. Susan finally said,
"Oh, probably no one you've ever heard of."
The girl had been wiping the counter as she talked with Susan, but now stopped and coldly stared.
"Nobody I've ever heard of, huh? Not Le Corbusier or Gropius or Gaudi or Sullivan or Mies van der Rohe? Hell, you could have gone with that old standby Frank Lloyd Wright."
Susan looked up in surprise, down in embarrassment.
Yeah, those are... How do you know all those names?"
"What, don't you ever read a fucking book? Or does it just not seem like I would? Give me back that fucking cigarette. I was trying to be nice to you. Like I give a shit about architects or damn college students. Get out of here."
And the girl turned her back on Susan, raising a middle finger over her shoulder as she did. Susan looked blank-minded at the cigarette she had been toying with, processing that the girl had said to give it back. She reached up to lay it on the counter, but fumbled and dropped it. The cigarette hit the pavement and cracked in two. Flustered, Susan picked up the two halves, still attached by torn paper. She tore off the filter half and laid it on the counter. Not thinking, she put the other half behind her ear, a thread of tobacco sticking to her cheek. She turned and headed off, looking for some place out of line of sight from that girl.
"Ugh, this town. Only thing worse was the stupid carnival this town decided it needed and the stupid people that worked it. Some carnival trash thinking they should school her in manners."
Susan's ears throbbed and flushed in anger and embarrassment. She ducked behind a flapping canvas tent, into an alley, looking back to see if anyone had witnessed her moment of embarrassment.
"Now that's a look," said a voice behind Susan. "Is that what the college kids are all wearing these days, that busted cig behind the ear look? I didn't even know you smoked."
Tom and Sammy were sitting on two upturned milk crates, just outside the back door of the restaurant that Tom's parents ran. They were passing a Budweiser between them. Susan and Tom, Tommy back then, had started kindergarten together and would have graduated together if Susan had stuck around.
"I mean, I don't smoke, really," Susan stammered. I mean, every now and then it's kind of fun, something to do."
And she took the half cig from behind her ear and flicked it into the gravel.
"Kind of early in the day for that, isn't it?"
Susan pointed at the bud and smiled, maybe a little too big.
"Do you have another one of those?"
"No, we just snuck the one out of the cooler," Tom said. "Dad won't miss one, but he might miss two or three. You back for the rest of the summer?" "No, I came tonight for this festival thing. Then I'm going back to Columbia tomorrow. I just finished my summer classes, but I have an apartment and..."
Yeah, big girl on campus now," Sammy interrupted. "We've heard all about it. I kind of figured we'd never see you again, and I wasn't too far off."
She had known these guys forever, but now she was feeling it. The distance and the growing strangeness. The realization that, at one time, she had known them her entire life. But soon, she would have known them only part of her life. And a shrinking part.
"So, what have you guys been up to?"
The most generic of questions, Susan thought. Something you would ask someone you really don't know, or care to know.
"Just doing whatever comes next," Tom said with thin cheerfulness. "I worked a little out on the Terry place and a few weeks on the county brush crew. I like the working outside. I'm doing what I can to stay out of the restaurant here. When you've seen the inside of a deep fat fryer, you lose your appetite for the stuff."
"What about you, Sammy? What have you been doing this summer?"
Susan had the sickening feeling that she sounded like she was interviewing them for the school newspaper or a class report. That she sounded like she really couldn't care less. Sammy set his eyes on the crumbling bricks of the back wall of the vacant building across the alley.
"I got on at Dinner Bell Foods, making them TV dinners. Just part-time now, fill-in stuff. But I'll go full-time whenever there's an opening. It's pretty good pay, but hey, don't ever eat them TV dinners."
Sammy laughed. There he was. That guy she'd known since second grade. Had laughed so hard with, even kissed one time. It was like watching him through a screen door.
"Other than that," Sammy went on, "just cruising and boozing. Went to a couple concerts, spent the 4th down at the lake."
Sammy passed the beer back to Tom.
"Yeah, just doing what comes next,"
Tom said again, then killed the bud and handed the empty to Sammy, who shook it and frowned.
"Are you going to go hear this band tonight?"
Sammy asked.
"They're blocking off the street and dragging in a trailer for a stage. They're advertising it as Teen Town. How fucking corny is that?"
"Probably one of the last times we'll get to enjoy all the blessings and benefits of being a teenager,"
Tom smirked. "You wouldn't want to miss that."
"Yeah, I don't know,"
Susan started, almost continuing with, "how long I can stand this place," then remembered these boys still were this place. So instead she said,
"I don't know, probably, yeah."
"By the way," Sammy said, "James was here last night asking about you."
Susan's field of vision shook ever so slightly, a feeling of lost balance. It took her a second to answer.
"Well, if you see him, tell him I said hi."
"Tell him yourself,"
Sammy said, and he crushed the aluminum can with a single stomp. Back at the house, Susan's mother, Emma Jean, made sandwiches for the two of them, then left to go put in her shift at the county extension booth, handing out brochures about pesticides and herbicides. Susan cleaned up the kitchen a bit, then walked into the silent living room. The room had the feeling of a museum or a historical recreation, a snapshot of how people lived in the second half of the 20th century. The dated colors and fabrics, the technology of their era, rapidly becoming obsolete and quaint. In the corner was a folding card table. On it, a half-completed jigsaw puzzle. Susan recognized the puzzle picture from her junior high years. Had her parents retrieved it from the attic, started working on it all over again? Or had it been sitting like that, right there, for years? She honestly didn't know. Susan stretched out on the couch, was staring at the ceiling fan, watching the silent rotation. She remembered when her dad had installed the ceiling fan, replacing an old box fan that rattled and sometimes sparked, several years before they finally got central air. It had seemed like such a big deal, having a fan on the ceiling, just like a store or a restaurant. Grade school Susan would sneak down in the middle of summer nights, when she was sure her parents were asleep. It was her secret pleasure to lay on the bare floor under the fan with her t-shirt bunched up under her chin, the moving night air, a soft pressure on her skin, a spray of invisible feathers. She would fall asleep and wake up cold and shivering, her father leading her back to bed. Even now, the fan and the memory were spinning her into sleep. She dreamed about winter. The sound of the back door closing hard woke Susan, and she heard her father's heavy shoes in the kitchen. Saturday afternoon was one of the few times her father, Ed, wasn't working or getting ready to go to work or sleeping. There were still a couple hours before he left for the afternoon newspaper delivery route. The Kansas City Star was published twice every day, once on Sunday, not just for the city, but for every small town within 100 miles. Ed would load 20 to 30 bundles of flat newspapers into a Plymouth Fury with a huge back seat and a big engine and drive off like a bat out of hell. Rolling newspapers, throwing them out the driver's window, he'd cover the entire town of Shorter. Then he would head out across 40 miles of farmland and blacktop and gravel to the town of Bernard, about the same size as Shorter, and drive every street in that town, too. The entire trip took 3.5 hours. Ed had owned the route for 7 years now, and in the first few months, the whole family had pitched in to help with rolling and delivery. But subscriptions had fallen off over the past few years, and Ed could handle the whole route by himself now.
"Hello, my girl," Ed said, walking into the living room. "I thought you'd be downtown, having a good old time, catching up with your friends." "Oh, I was down there, but it got so hot, and I got hungry and sleepy. I needed a nap."
Susan yawned to prove it.
"Are you going to the dance tonight? It's supposed to cool off a bit by then." "Yeah, I think I'll go on down to the dance," Susan said. "But I'll probably skip the talent show. All those people lip-syncing bad songs, kind of hard to sit through. The band for the street dance is from the city. Supposed to be pretty good. And, like Tommy told me earlier,"
Susan forced a laugh,
"it might be our last time to get to be teenagers. That last time can't come soon enough for me."
"Oh, come on now," and Ed jerked, like someone had poked him. "You've still got almost 2 years of being a teenager left. Listen to your old man. Don't be in such a hurry. You'll be surprised at how fast things start clicking by you now. Really, I shouldn't even tell you about that. Better to find out later, after it's already happened."
Appeasingly, Susan said, "Okay, I promise not to grow up."
Ed looked at her long. "All right, I'll remind you of that promise sometime." He looked longer. "I have a real big favor to ask you."
"Sure, what?"
Susan figured he wanted a sandwich or something. "Would you want to run the route with me in the morning? The Sunday edition is supposed to be pretty small, at least smaller than usual. So, not much heavy lifting involved."
Ed smiled.
He walked closer and sat in one of the armchairs, his chair. Screen doors were opening and closing for Susan today, clarity shifting and changing, some things fading to blur, some becoming sharp and cutting. She could see, maybe for the first time, how tired her father looked, and suddenly, old. Ed's hair, his only point of vanity, always carefully combed straight back, and the small waves pushed slightly forward and up. Susan saw was thin and receding deep over his temples. A few brown spots shone through on Ed's scalp, his eyes and his teeth noticeably yellow.
"Oh, geez, Dad, I'm going to be up late going to the dance, and I've got to drive back tomorrow."
I know, Ed said, and waited. Dust and silence floated in the afternoon light, suspended. "But truth is," Ed went on, "this is probably the last time you'll get the chance. We'll get the chance. I'm going to try to sell the route before the end of the year. And the way your life and your schedule's been going, you might not even be home again before that happens. I'd just like to share a sunrise with you one more time. And there's supposed to be a meteor shower in the wee hours just before the sun comes up. Might be something to see." And Ed raised his eyebrows.
"Why are you selling the route?" Susan asked. "I thought you liked it and the money was good."
"Well, the money isn't what it was a couple years ago," Ed said. "Do you know I drive over 50,000 miles every year? The expenses, the gas and repairs and such, just keep going up while the income keeps sinking little by little. We'll be able to get a better price for the route if we sell it now, instead of waiting for the bottom to fall out. And to tell you the truth, I'm getting tired of waking up at 3 a.m. every single day of the year. It's been a good run, but I'm ready for a change and a good night's sleep." Susan thought for a moment.
"All right. Wake me at 3 and I'll try to get up and go with you. I can't promise. It depends on how long I stay at the street dance, which might not be very long."
"Okay, then. If I don't see you at dinner or downtown, I guess I'll see you in the morning, sooner or later. You might not see me, but I'll see you one way or the other. Have a good time tonight, sweetie. Try to. I gotta go run some errands, fix some stuff on the car before route time."
"What time is it?"
Susan asked. "Almost 2, Ed said, getting up from his chair, giving Susan a quick kiss on the head, and heading out the back door. A hard slam, the muffled mechanics of the car door, the crunch of the gravel drive, the fading roar of a big engine. Susan killed the afternoon visiting her grandmother, sorting through some boxes in her bedroom, finding things she might need in Columbia, thinking of one excuse after another to not go back down to the festival and the heat. She also felt in her chest the growing avoidance to the idea of seeing any of her old classmates and friends, particularly James. He had always been James, never Jim or Jimmy. His family had moved to Shorter when he and Susan were in the 3rd grade. One of those families that arrives, no relatives in the area, no particular reason or explanation for their moving to town. But they had the manner, the means, whatever it was, that made the whole family, the 4 kids, quickly fit into the community, become popular. Susan and James. James and Susan. They had immediately liked each other, though for the first several years it was only shown through the usual teasing and insults. Then, around 8th grade, when boys and girls start realigning, really noticing each other, all that stopped and was replaced by 2 years of careful avoidance and ignoring. During their sophomore year, their circles and activities finally overlapped enough that they could safely and carefully get to know each other all over again. And for the first time. They dated for almost 2 years, a lifetime at that age. They had fun and companionship and that first strange sensation of giving and belonging to someone else. They'd learned that hazy border between friendship and romance, the awkward first dance of sex and desire, learned what jealousy really meant, had at least started to learn what honesty and trust were about. But Susan had known, somewhere in the back of her forward vision, that it would all have to end. Her plans, which at that point could be named little more than escape, did not include any tethers that could reel her back to Shorter. Susan had broken up with James almost 1 year ago, the summer before their senior year, and she knew she had not been kind about it. There was no way to be. She couldn't explain to James what she couldn't explain to herself. Yes, she might and probably would see James downtown tonight. She would be kind, another trait she was trying to understand, sometimes practice. But she really hoped James just wouldn't be there, that his pride or heartache or self-preservation, whatever, would steer him in another direction, away from Susan. The evening was not cooler. even more humid, if that was possible. She had labored over what to wear tonight from the few items she had in her closet. Most of her choice clothes were in Columbia. She had settled on a simple white cotton dress, slightly peasant in its styling. In that struggle between hoping that no one saw her at all and hoping that people did see her and perceived that she was different now, maybe more grown up, certainly less small town, she decided that the white dress was the closest thing she had to a clean slate. She wasn't even sure why she was going. For all the things, all the people and questions and exchanges she wanted to avoid, there was something else, something lower in frequency, longer in wave, some stone or tag base that she needed to touch one more time before it would finally let her go. Ollie, Ollie, in free. If she could arrive at the street dance after the music had started, and after most everyone had already paid their admission, maybe she could slip in unnoticed, music already blasting away conversations, even hellos. Susan could hear the band playing from two blocks away as she approached. That was good. That was great. This might work after all. Keeping her head down, her gaze on the sidewalk and her pace brisk, Susan weaved around slow walkers and chatting groups, intentionally ignoring and not deciphering shouts and greetings that might be directed at her. She wished she'd worn a hat.
Hey, you made it!
Tom and Sammy were paying their admission, blocking her quick disappearance into the crowd. Tom's noontime Budweiser had obviously been the start to a long day of more of the same.
Shit, Susie, get in line ahead of us. Come on in with us. I want to dance. You got to dance with me.
Tom blurred, his eyes closing as he spoke. He reached out to touch Susan, but she stepped back out of his reach.
Man, you are not coming in here. I told you that 15 minutes ago.
Rex Brock, the high school football coach, a big guy, was taking admissions and trying to impress some amount of order and vigilance on the kids as they entered.
Sammy, you need to get him out of here. Get him home. If you guys hadn't graduated already, I would have your ass. Now go, scoot.
Tom stood, swaying like a balloon on a string, slowly losing helium, staring at Coach, through Coach, like he was trying to see through a wall or into the future. And maybe he did see it, a quick and unsettling glimpse.
Fuck this shit. This is for kids. Let's go, Sammy.
Tom grabbed Sammy's arm, as much for support as for exit. Paying her admission, Susan stepped out of the dome of can light by the entrance gate. She looked for a hiding place, aware that she was willingly walking into a crowd of people she knew, and then looking for a place to hide from them. A crisp contradiction. The area cordoned off for the street dance was the half block just off the main square, starting at one corner of the four-way stop, ending just before the alley that ran behind the west row of brick buildings. A perimeter of orange plastic fencing surrounded the open street, a large flat trailer brought in to serve as a stage. Somehow, they had tractored down four banks of the old bleachers from the football field and put them inside the dance area so people could have some place to sit, and so chaperones could keep an eye on things from a vantage point. Susan saw a wide-open spot on the top row of one of the bleachers, high enough to see over the heads of the crowd, hopefully far enough back as not to be conspicuous. She climbed and took a seat, just as the band finished a song and announced they were going on break. Geez, what time did they start? Susan wondered. People began milling and conversing, heading for the exit to go to the car for a beer, no doubt. Others headed for the bleachers where Susan was sitting, filling in the spaces and empty seats, stepping up to the higher rows. It was like watching floodwaters rise. As the band's blinding stage lights went dark, Susan realized she was sitting directly under a street lamp. She felt like she was on a high stool under a spotlight, waiting for her interrogation. Feeling a low panic rising in her chest, Susan looked for a way to get off the bleachers, to escape. It would be too difficult, too conspicuous to try to step over and through and around all the bodies that were filling up the seats below her. Someone was bound to stop her and talk to her, and she just wasn't up for that. At least, not yet. The only way out was over the back, off the top seat, a 10-foot drop. But the metal frame of the bleachers had a long diagonal brace on the backside that ran from the top corner to the bottom. For decades of softball and football games, little kids had climbed that diagonal brace and slid back down it like a slalom skier. Susan had done that daring move dozens of times when she was in grade school, but, of course, that was a while back. Here we go. Doing a spin backwards, slowly, as not to draw attention, Susan lifted and dangled her legs over the back of the bleachers, finding the diagonal brace with her sandaled feet. It was a narrower beam than she remembered, but she found her footing and began the slide down, keeping a grip on the seat as she descended, gradually letting go. But something stopped her movement. Susan saw that her dress was hung up on the splintered edge of the plank board, and the dress was pulled up nearly to her waist now. Grasping the top plank, exerting and pulling herself back up the beam, Susan steadied herself with an elbow and tugged on the dress. There was the sound of fabric beginning to rip.
"Damn, I love this dress," Susan thought,
as she shimmied her way higher, finally getting her waist, then her hips back on the plank. Seated again, back where she started, Susan proceeded to loosen the dress tail from the splintered edge of the board, careful not to tear it further. Finally, she worked the threads free and, bunching the dress around her waist, slipped off the plank and started a second descent. There was no catching of threads, no tearing of material this time. Instead, the bare flesh of her hip scraped hard into the splinters as she came off the plank and onto the beam. Opening her mouth, wide but silent, Susan twisted away from the splinters, struggling to keep her balance.
"Fuck!"
she wheezed. Hand over hand, working her way down the narrow iron incline, Susan finally reached the ground. She smoothed her dress into place and let out a frustrated sigh, looking up to see threads of her dress hanging from the splintery board above her.
"Well, that was quite a show,"
a voice from beneath the adjoining set of bleachers. Another voice added,
"Wished I'd had a camera, or at least a flashlight."
The street lamp threw bars of carved-up yellow-purple light into the space, divided by charcoal blackness. Susan held a hand above her brow, frowned in the direction of the voices, but she knew who it was. Tom and Sammy sat on a low-frame beam, passing a half pint of something between them.
"I thought they kicked you guys out,"
Susan said.
"Oh, they did, fucking coach," Tom said, taking a drink. "But security isn't exactly tight around here. We just slipped under the fence where it meets the alley. You want?"
And Tom held the bottle of schnapps out to Susan. She took it.
"What the hell were you doing anyway?"
Sammy asked.
"Same thing as you, I guess. Hiding. But probably for a different reason. I just kind of don't want to talk to anybody here. You guys are okay, though."
Susan passed the bottle back.
"Hear that, Tommy? Us guys are okay. Aren't you glad?"
"I didn't mean it like that,"
Susan started. Tommy cut her off.
"Oh, don't worry about it. I know what you mean. We're pretty well sick of everybody here, too. At least you don't have to live here anymore."
Tommy looked straight at Susan through the striped darkness. "I bet you never will again."
"I didn't say I was sick of it," Susan said. "I just don't feel like talking to people tonight." "I guess you guys aren't people." Susan shot a smile.
"Gee, that's the nicest bloody thing you ever said to me,"
Sammy answered in something close to a British accent. Susan sat down on the edge of a concrete block that was leveling the back end of the bleachers. The bottle was passed and sipped, and they picked up where they had left off earlier in the afternoon. Shit was shot, all the basics. Who broke up with who got drunk and puked and cried, who got a ticket, where some were headed in the fall. Music, movies, weddings, and funerals. Space increasing between the lines.
"I'm thinking about enlisting," Tom said,
an abrupt change of mood.
"In the army?"
Susan asked, genuinely surprised.
Wow, news to me, Sammy said. Why the fuck would you want to do that?
Probably the Army, Tom went on. Maybe the Marines if they'll take me. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to college, that's pretty clear. At least this would get me out of town, throw me some surprises.
Well, you fucking surprised me, Sammy said, almost sounding angry. When do you plan to make this grand gesture?
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
The subject trailed off. The band was starting up again. The bottle was empty. Susan was feeling less conspicuous, less careful.
Come on, Susie. You promised you'd dance with me at least once, Tom said, getting up and stepping out behind the bleachers.
I don't think we ever discussed it, Susan laughed.
You were too busy arguing with Coach, but yeah, sure, let's go dance.
I'm staying here, Sammy said, taking a joint out of his shirt pocket and a lighter from his jeans, slipping further back into the shadows.
Well, now you get that out. Fuck it, we're going to go dance. Save some of that for me.
Tom put a shaky arm on Susan's shoulder and nearly shoved her toward the crowd, then took the lead, pushing his wobbly way down to the front of the stage, dragging Susan along.
Jesus, it's loud!
Susan shouted, then closed her eyes. She was surprised how quickly the schnapps had hit her, but of course, she had eaten almost nothing today. She should probably get some food. She should probably sit back down. But that reasoning was evaporating, along with her self-consciousness. Susan closed her eyes, held her arms out to her sides, first to get her balance, then to find the opening into the music, into the volume and the intense low frequencies that were hitting her in the stomach in both a good and bad way. She moved. She danced. For the 3 or so minutes of this song, everything made an odd kind of sense. The night, the people around her, her parents probably standing within 100 yards of here, the highway back to Columbia, this song, these lights. She could see how it all fit together, though she wouldn't have been able to explain that to anyone, nor herself, in so many words. Susan lost track of time. Not in the way where a person is early or late for whatever is supposed to happen next in their life, but in a way that for the briefest of moments, for the smallest of windows, Susan could feel her past and her present, her feet on the asphalt, now, right now, and all the many steps that had brought her to this point. She was here. She was from here. She would always be from here, wherever she went. The song ended, and the trance was broken. Susan opened her eyes and looked up at the band on the stage.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The next song started. Susan looked around for Tom. There he was. But he was talking to another girl now, shouting in her ear, sort of dancing with her. For some reason, this didn't bother Susan at all. It was hard to tell who was dancing with whom anyway, and she was fine just closing her eyes and trying to find that feeling of invisibility again. There it was. Another song, and another. Eye contact with the one singing the song. More closed-eyed dancing. Another break for the band. Some hellos and chit-chat. The evening that she had so dreaded dissolved and reformed into something familiar, even fun. And somewhere on the edges of her thought, Susan knew this was the last time. This was a goodbye. She had the conscious, if somewhat blurry, thought that there were people here tonight that she would never see again in her life. And that was all right, not even sad. The band started up again for a final set. The dance ended at midnight, so they only had about 20 minutes to play. But Susan was getting tired and headed back to the bleachers to sit for a while and watch, climbing up to the same spot she had so awkwardly escaped from an hour ago. Susan looked over the crowd, silhouetted by the stage lights. She played a game, recognizing and naming people by their cutouts and their movements. Over the black edges of 200 haircuts, Susan suddenly saw James, not silhouetted at all, but standing in the spotlight of the entrance gate. James of the broken heart, of her unkindness, and his persistence. Even at this distance, across this expanse of asphalt and sweating moving bodies and fencing and seats, Susan could tell he was staring straight at her, a cold blankness on his face. Any lingering illusion of invisibility vanished completely, and that earlier feeling of conspicuous vulnerability returned, times two. Earlier, she worried that everyone might be looking at her. Now, everyone didn't matter. James was looking at her, staring at her, a pinpoint of hurt accusation. It was too much. Not now. Susan vacated the bleachers again, not over the back this time, just a simple walk down the steps of seats. She doubled back behind the bleachers into the space beneath, half expecting to find Tom and Sammy there again, sharing that joint. But there was no one. She pulled back into the shadows and sat on the concrete block where she had sat before. There were a few people on the seats above her, but no one seemed to notice her movements under the bleachers. She would just sit it out, yes. Just stay here in the darkness under the bleachers until everyone left. Sure, why not? The band finished their final song. No encore was demanded. Stage lights were extinguished. Conversation surged, then leveled and faded, as people slowly made their way out the gate, some just stepping on and over the orange plastic fencing. Equipment was unplugged and carried off. The people above Susan on the bleachers made out for a while, then stepped down to the pavement, arms around each other, and walked away. Through the planks, Susan could see the band members putting guitars and drums into cases. While on stage, they had looked like talented and angry young men, exotic and unreachable. Now, in the dull reality of a single clip-on work light, they just looked like tired boys wearing silly costumes, playing dress-up and make-believe. Someone started detaching and rolling up the plastic fencing, and Susan realized she would be found out in the upcoming minutes, and it was time to go. She deeply hoped that James had lost sight of her, given up and gone on with his night and his life. She came out from her bleacher cave and saw that the fencing had already been removed from the mouth of the alley. That would provide her some more shadowy cover, should she need it. And, like the people and the sidewalks and the tree roots of the town, Susan knew clearly where this alley started and stopped, turned and resumed, bled into backyards. Eventually, it led to her house. Rounding the corner into the alley, Susan saw a van, old and rusted, hitched to a trailer, new and rented. The band members were lugging cases and speaker boxes and crates of lights and wires into the trailer, some into the back seats of the van.
"Hey, I really liked your band. That was fun," Susan said,
not to any one person in particular.
"Thanks. Yeah, thanks. Thank you,"
replied tired voices, barely looking up as they lifted and loaded. The one who had sung most of the songs walked over to Susan.
"Oh, yeah?" he questioned. "Which song was your favorite?"
Susan locked, unable to come up with the title of any single song she had heard them play.
They were all good, great, really rockin'."
She tried to sound discerning, knowledgeable, but was sure she came off as silly, maybe even stupid.
"I'm sorry."
She looked down.
"I was kind of drunk. Am kind of drunk."
"Oh, that's all right." And the boy smiled. "I wish I was, but I have to drive this van back to the city tonight. I'm Polly."
And he reached out his hand.
"Okay,"
Susan thought, and reached out her hand in return, Polly taking it and just holding it, squeezing it slightly.
"I saw you dancing down front while I was singing," Polly said. "I couldn't tell who you were dancing with, like maybe you were doing that solo dancing thing. So nobody walking you home either?"
"No, just me. I live a few blocks from here. That is, I used to. I'm in school at Columbia now, just home for the weekend for the festival. I think your band has been the best part."
"Well, thanks. Living in Columbia, huh? We play there sometimes. I think we're booked at the Blue Note in October."
Polly paused, tilting his head.
"We've pretty much got everything loaded up, but Robert has to go find this woman Rita that hired us to get paid. She's off somewhere counting money, is what we're told. So, I've got a little time. You want to take a walk around? Just the downtown here. No dark alleys, I promise.
Well, yeah, sure,
Susan answered, caught off guard.
I'm glad it's cooled off a little.
And just like that, we're talking about the weather, Polly laughed. Come on, let's go look at this broken-down carnival. What's your name?
Oh, yeah, I'm Susan.
She slid her hands into the small pockets on the sides of her white dress, just to have some place to put them. Her left hand went into a pocket. Her right hand touched the bare skin of her hip. She looked down, felt and saw a long tear, starting just below her underwear, running in a zigzag nearly to the bottom seam. Susan couldn't believe she hadn't noticed it or felt it. No one probably saw the tear, or her butt, in all the crowded dancing and flashing lights. But geez, why did something embarrassing always seem to happen when she drank? And why right now? Wait, did she tear that before the booze?
I tore my dress on the bleachers,
Susan said, needing to make it known she wasn't that oblivious.
Oh, it just gives you more of that vagabond look. It's all right, I won't peek.
They cut across the nearly empty town square, under the four-way stop, Susan's dangling hand trying to hold the dress together at the tear. They could hear the country band playing in the beer garden halfway down the block, could see a few people coming and going at the entrance. The country band was singing something about jukeboxes and one more round. Polly frowned and turned to Susan.
Do you like country music, like this stuff they're playing?
Susan answered cautiously.
Oh, you know, it's okay, in the right place, right time. My dad always listened to Johnny Cash, and even some old Jimmy Rogers records. Sometimes that old stuff sounds pretty good to me, and, you know, it always reminds me of my dad.
Is your dad not living anymore?
Oh, no, he's fine, alive and kicking. So's my mom. It's just, now that I don't live at home, all those little reminders keep popping up and surprising me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and Polly chuckled. Actually, I do. My dad, he's been gone almost 3 years now. Cancer got him. When I was little and we'd be going someplace, he would always say, "We gotta go, me oh my oh." And I thought that was just one of his sayings. Then eventually I find out it's from a Hank Williams song. Now, every time I hear Hank Williams, which is surprisingly often considering I don't really like country music, I always think of that song and my dad.
I love you a bushel and a peck.
And Susan smiled.
What?
No, that's what my grandma used to say to me whenever she gave me a hug. I love you a bushel and a peck and a hug around the neck. And I thought that was something she just said. But turns out that's from a song, too.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the reasons I like playing music so much.
Polly looked up at the water tower as he spoke. Music, songs, they weave into real life, even when you don't know it. And it makes you feel stuff and feel it deeper. It's like a kind of magic, maybe the last kind of magic. Polly's view went from the sky down to the pavement. He hesitated. Then he said,
I've been trying to write a few songs myself.
Really? That's cool,
Susan said, again hoping that she didn't sound silly. She took a chance.
Can you sing me one of them?
Oh, what? No, my guitar's already in the van and...
Polly stuttered to silence. Susan didn't press it.
So, how do you do that? How do you make up a song?
She asked.
I'm just now kind of getting the hang of it. It's like thinking and not thinking at the same time. Like not paying attention, but taking notes while you don't pay attention. I try to shut off and shut out all the noise around me. And when it gets quiet enough, I can hear a song in my head. Does that make any sense?
Susan thought about it a moment.
I'm studying architecture at college,
she started, gathering her thoughts.
The reason I like it is because I've always thought about what would make our house or my room or some place, really any place, feel better on my brain. What kind of space would make my mind feel better? It was just something I always did since I was little. I could see it in my imagination,
how a wall should be in a different place, or a door or window was not where it should be. Is that kind of the same thing, just imagining something that's almost there, but not quite?
Architecture and songwriting, who would have thought they're like the same thing? Pauly smiled.
You're making fun of me.
No, really, I'm not. I think that's exactly it. Whether you're an architect or a musician or a house painter or a teacher or a mechanic or some guy pushing a broom, you're just trying to move things where you think they should be, but aren't quite. Just trying to make things look, or in my case, sound right. Be right.
What the fuck, Susan?
A voice from behind a car across the dark street. It was James.
What do you want?
Susan could think of no other reply or statement or question.
What are you doing with this guy?
James slurred.
Is this who you're fucking now?
I'm not Don't say that to me, Susan flared. You need to get out of here and leave us alone.
And who the fuck are you?
James aimed at Pauly. Hey, my friend, you are drunk. Be cool now. We just met 5 minutes ago. I played in the band at the dance.
Yeah, dumbass, I know that. And you guys sucked.
A voice bounced from down the block.
Hey, Pauly, come on, man, we gotta go.
Shit, under his breath.
I'll be there in a minute,
Pauly shouted back, then turned to Susan. Why don't you walk back to the van with me and we'll give you a ride home?
No, go on. I can handle this. I need to handle this, Susan said. I broke up with this guy like a year ago and it just pisses me off he thinks he can do this.
Are you sure? This doesn't look good.
I am not afraid of this guy. I'll handle it. I mean, look, he's still standing behind a car. He's either too drunk or too chicken to even walk over here. Go.
Pauly huffed a sigh, made a long sound of, eh, then walked away, shaking his head, looking back several times. The words, fucking small towners, trailing off as he left.
That was a really jerk-ass thing to do.
Susan was angry now.
I can't believe you would follow me. I mean, Jesus, James, it's been over a year. You can't do this.
James finally and slowly walked around the car, leaning slightly forward like his head and his feet were disagreeing.
I can't do this,
James almost shouted.
You can't do this.
Can't do what? Susan said slowly, trying to calm herself down, but only adding tension to the spring.
Not you, not anybody, but particularly not you get to tell me what to do. We dated in high school, even went together, if you need to call it something. But high school's over, James. Grow the fuck up.
James did his tilted walk over closer to Susan, his eyes going to the inch of her bare hip that showed through the tear in her dress.
Did that asshole do that? Did he tear your dress when you were going at it? I'll kill him.
And James ran out of steam and pronunciation.
No, James. I tore it on the bleachers, Susan said through gritting teeth. Pauly never so much as touched me.
She was so angry at him, but also immediately angry with herself for even starting with an explanation. James took another step closer, stumbled and bent. He lunged in Susan's direction, his arms extended, fingernails grazing her hip as he grabbed at her, trying to stay upright. Susan reflexively tucked her hips, stepped back and sideways. James's forward motion carried him a few tangled steps farther, then down, his face hitting the pavement hard. He yelled and rolled onto his side, hands to his scraped face, his bleeding nose. Susan gasped, wondered if James was all right. Was he hurt? But her concern and sympathy sizzled and evaporated, a water droplet on a skillet. She shook her head and turned to walk away, leave him there. As she passed behind James to get out of the street and onto the sidewalk, he grabbed blindly behind, finding Susan's ankle. She twisted and stumbled, almost going down. A quick kick at his hand, and James let go, a shout of new pain. "Don't you ever touch me again." Susan's voice was calm and steady, but chilled with certainty.
"Ever."
Susan stood there and seethed. She wasn't having it. With as much strength and swing as she could find in that moment, she kicked James hard in the ass. Twice. Susan counted the sidewalk cracks on her limping walk home, just to occupy her mind, distract from the pain in her toe. The buzzing of her thoughts was almost audible, an itching noise that she needed to walk off. Looking at the consecutive sidewalk lines, like rolling TV static, Susan watched her sandals come in and out of the picture and felt distinctly disconnected from them. They were moving on their own, and she was an immeasurable wrong distance above them. She was watching an old home movie of every walk she had ever taken in the town, now in grainy, underdeveloped black and white, a loop over and over. Susan eventually found herself at her own back door, not really sure if she had taken the most direct route home or if she had been wandering a while. But she sensed that some time had passed. The clock on the kitchen wall read 1:37. All was quiet, a familiar and comforting near absence of sound, save for the low hums of a sleeping house. Without turning on any lights, Susan made her way into the living room, absently found and flipped the switch for the overhead fan. She lay down in the space between the couch and the coffee table, a narrow strip of cool hardwood floor directly under the fan. The mood of the day, the events of the evening, circled her. But the soft parachute of night air was moving it all to a distance, holding it there. A slit of distant streetlight caught the very edge of the blurred fan blades, winking at her, a misplaced star alone on the black ceiling. She raised her hips and pulled her dress up above her waist, felt the soothing touch of the moving air, raised the dress on up under her chin. The sour taste of anger was still in her mouth, her foot throbbing from impact. Her lower back hurt, and there was a stinging on her hip. The discomfort kept her distracted from the confusion of the day, the tangled knot of faces and memories and feelings. She drifted. She slept. Small rattlings in the kitchen woke her. The hesitant sounds of someone trying to be quiet. The smell of coffee. The soft glow of the stove light. Through the angled doorway, Susan could see her father, already dressed, getting ready to run the paper out. He always made 2 pieces of toast, 1 cup of coffee for now, and enough for 2 more cups on the road from the red plaid thermos. Older than she was. Ed startled a little when he noticed Susan standing in the kitchen doorway.
"I'm sorry, I was trying to be quiet, sweetie. I think I heard you come in pretty late, huh? I doubt you feel like going with me."
No, I do want to go. I don't know how much help I'll be or if I can stay awake, but I do want to go."
Susan stopped herself from saying, "This might be our last time."
"Well, huh, that's a nice surprise. Sure. You want some coffee and toast? You'll get car sick if you don't have something on your stomach."
Susan had heard Ed say that so many times. Ed pointed to Susan's torn dress, her hip.
"What happened to you? It looks like you're bleeding a little."
Susan looked down, pulling the tear together with a quick pinch, noticing small pinpoints of blood on the white cotton. Had that been there earlier? Scrapes? Splinters?
"Oh, I caught my dress on the boards of the old bleachers. I guess I picked up a splinter or two. I hadn't noticed that. It doesn't hurt."
Ed glanced at the stove clock.
"Well, we need to go in about 5 minutes. Are you sure you want to do this?"
Yes, I'm sure. Let me just run up and change. I'll be quick. Butter me some toast, would you?"
Susan grabbed jeans and a t-shirt from her bedroom, went in the bathroom to pee and change. Examining her hip, she saw 3 long scratches, not deep, but breaking the skin enough to bring a slow seep of blood. A warm washcloth, a daub of antibiotic. She got dressed. The ride to the drop point, the unloading and loading of the bundles of newspapers, friendly banter between her dad and Pete the driver, asking who this stranger was. It had been several years since she had seen this ritual. It was odd to think that it happened like this every single morning of every single day, whether she was there or not. Even though it had been months, many months, since Susan had done this, her hands fell into the automatic motions of folding, folding, rubber band, stack, repeat. A bundle of newspapers on the floor between her feet, another on top to roll from. Finish a bundle, pull another up from the back seat, pop the wire cutters. Ed wheeled the big Plymouth through the loops and small straights of the town. Barely slowing at the stop signs, he hurled the big Sunday newspaper onto front steps and yards just as quickly as Susan could roll them. She never did understand how Ed could remember who got a paper and who didn't. The delivery around Shorter took about a half hour. Susan was starting to feel a little woozy from the motion, the smell of the ink, the short night. They headed out of town on the long, straight blacktop, the country night air rushing in the open window, cool and fresh, making Susan feel a little less nauseous.
"So, how was the dance?" Ed finally asked. "Looked like you stayed for the whole thing, and then some. Your mom and I saw James at the talent show. He didn't look so good. But he said hi and asked if you were in town. And of course we couldn't lie to him. Did he find you?"
"Yeah, unfortunately."
Susan paused.
How much did she really want to tell? "He said hi, and that was about it. He seemed pretty drunk, which I didn't like to see. I wish he'd just go on."
"Well, you're both at that age where there's a lot of sorting and searching to do. We always thought you two would stick it out."
"Stick it out? Heck, Dad, we didn't get married or anything even close."
"Well, since you brought it up, that might not be such a bad idea. You two could get married and go figure out life together."
This idea, and the head-shaking thought that it had been in her father's mind at all, brought Susan to a stunned silence. Finally, she said,
"Well, that's not going to happen."
A breath. "Particularly after tonight." And she regretted the words before she was even through saying them, and the door that it cracked.
"What? Why? What happened?"
Susan let out a huff sigh.
"I kind of had to kick him."
"Kick him?"
Ed was alarmed.
"Did he hit you? Did he hurt you?"
"No."
And Susan laughed nervously, inappropriately at this, she knew. But it was a relief to say it, to make it real. Ed rolled down his window and hurled a newspaper over the car at the high bank of a farmhouse yard. He barely slowed down.
"What happened?" Ed asked again.
"Oh, James was real drunk after the dance, and I was talking to this guy, and James came up and got really rude, and the guy had to leave. Then James got weird with me, and I just lost it. He fell down, and I kicked him in the butt pretty hard."
"Good Lord, girl. Did he do that to you, that tear in your dress and the blood?"
Susan could hear a mix of anger and panic rising in Ed's voice.
No, he didn't. I really did tear it on the bleachers and get scratched on some splinters. But he sort of grabbed at me and it scared me and, I don't know, I just sort of blew up. I think I hurt my foot when I kicked him."
Ed threw another paper, long and hard, out into the blackness, making a slight grunt as he released it. Susan could see a distant pole light and the ghost lines of a farmhouse far off the road. Ed rolled up the window, and they rode in silence. "Good," Ed finally said. And that was it. If he didn't need to hear more, Susan was glad to let it drop. She could hear Ed swallow hard several times over the next rolling miles and minutes. They passed through a crossroads community, what used to be an actual town, but now dwindled to a post office and maybe a store, just an address, an empty old schoolhouse, and a gas station with no pumps. A cloud cover had rolled in. The rolling hills were indistinct sleeping giants, fallen nightwalkers, random points of light standing in for the stars. Susan was nodding in and out between car sickness and bad dreams. Ed's hand on her shoulder woke her.
Sorry, hon, but I need you to roll some. We're almost to Bernard. I would have done some, but after what you told me, I thought I should keep my eyes and mind on the road.
Yeah. No, that's why I came, to help you out.
Susan assembled the words.
I'll get to going.
Susan's stomach was sourly turning, her head dragging from broken sleep, a low throb. The machine re-engaged, Susan rolling and banding as fast as she could, Ed tossing papers straight left, over the car right, block after block. Susan fought to keep her eyes open, her hands moving, her nausea waiting. The town, the turns, seemed to go on without end, but actually, they covered the town in just under an hour. The back seat of the car was nearly empty now. The majority delivered. Only a few dozen papers for the roundabout return to Shorter.
Daddy, I'm really not feeling too good, and I've got just about everything rolled. Is it okay if I crawl into the back seat and lie down? I just can't stay awake anymore. I think my short night is catching up with me.
Sure, babe. Just push all that junk into the floorboard and stretch out. I really appreciate you helping me out. Probably shaved 20 minutes off my route. I usually have to stop and roll a bunch before each town. And I know we didn't talk a lot, but it's just nice to have you along with me. One more time.
Ed didn't stop the car. Susan just did a smooth slide over the front seat into the back, another move she hadn't done for years. A better and easier descent than earlier in the evening. She pushed the brown paper bundle wrappers into the floorboard, wadded up the sharp binding wires, and stretched out on the cool vinyl. Ed reached under his seat, and without looking back, placed his light rain jacket over Susan. Even on this warm night, the jacket and the smell of her father was a welcome wrap of comfort. Susan drifted into the unusual sleep that goes with speed. She would rouse when Ed opened the window to throw a newspaper, the blast of way-late night air moving her hair and splashing her face, almost wet. Through the back windshield, the clouds thinned and broke to give up the moon now and then. The smell of fields and dirt and animals, growing and dying, past and present, the future under the topsoil, scented Susan's half-sleep. The drone of tires on road. A big engine, changing pitch, changing crunch, slowing and revving, but never stopping. Long, long, long. The violin screech of tires, the thud of flesh and hide and bone on chrome, the vertigo of forward motion becoming rotation, the slow motion and broken vision field of mind processing the sudden and the uneven, the harshness of silence. And stop. Susan breathed, shallow and hard, afraid to break the quiet, afraid to ask.
Dad, Dad, are you okay? Are we okay? What?
I'm all right. Are you okay?
Ed's voice was shaky and small.
We hit a deer. In all these years.
Susan reached up and turned on the dome light. Ed turned and looked back at her. His mouth open, his nose bleeding and crooked, already swelling.
I think I hit the steering wheel,
he said, his voice plugged and hollow. He pulled a handful of tissue from the glove box and held it to his nose.
Oh, jeez,
his voice in a tunnel. Susan had slammed hard from the seat into the floorboard, onto the piles of brown wrapper paper and wadded wire. She eased herself out of the low space and back onto the seat. With her came one longish piece of steel wire, the bigger part under her leg, the shorter part protruding vertically from her denim-covered thigh. No blood, hardly any pain. Just the strange sight of thin, shiny wire standing vertically where it absolutely shouldn't be. Susan lifted and rolled onto her side, feeling where the wire met her jeans on the back of her thigh. The spot becoming wet and warm now.
She pinched the wire and pulled gently, feeling, almost hearing, the wet squeak of flesh against steel and the surreal sight of the top of the wire disappearing into her jeans. Slow, steady, and clean, she pulled the wire from her leg. She looked up to tell Ed, but somewhere in Susan's shock and concentration, Ed had opened the door and left the car. Susan pulled up on her elbows, turned off the dome light, and looked out the windshield. But all she could see were stars and thin clouds. No road, no horizon. Gaining her bearings, Susan realized the car was sitting at a steep angle, nose in the air, the back end down in a ditch. She was able to open a back door and slide out into tall grass and weeds, finding her footing on the slippery bank. Susan's pierced leg was feeling it now, not so much an actual pain, more of an itch, a low electric shock. On hands and sliding feet, she made her way back up to the road. She found Ed some distance behind, a moving flashlight beam, kneeling over the deer in the center of the road. She walked to Ed, a limp starting to catch, the same leg as her hurt foot. As she got closer, she could hear him sobbing very softly. Ed's hand was on the shoulder of the deer. There was no blood, no wound, just the cratering stillness of life gone. Ed wiped his eyes as he saw Susan. She knelt beside him, wincing as she did, one hand on his shoulder, the other on the deer's side, smooth and hot.
"What do we do, Dad? We need to get her to the side of the road so nobody hits her later. Come on, grab a back leg."
Susan could hear the boy in her father's voice, sad and shaken, something she had never heard before. They each grabbed a back leg of the deer and dragged it over to the gravel and weeds that bordered the blacktop. The deer was surprisingly light. Ed knelt again, putting his ear to the chest of the deer, shaking his head. Susan knelt with him, her legs starting to stiffen.
"There's a farmhouse about a mile ahead, the Gardner place. God, I hate to wake people at this hour, but maybe Henry can bring the tractor down and chain us out of the ditch. We'll hope the car can get us back home. You want to walk there with me or stay here?"
"I'd better stay here," Susan said. "My leg hurts. One of those wires poked through it. I don't think I should walk that far."
"Through it? Oh, God, are you bleeding? I've got a little first aid kit in the glove."
"I'm bleeding a little, I think, but not too much. I'll be okay. But probably the sooner we get back home, the better."
Ed started to say something. Susan didn't let him.
"Really, I'll be all right. Get going."
Ed got up, stroking the back of Susan's head as he did. He looked back a couple times as he headed up the road, but soon all Susan could make out was the flashlight beam, fading, then disappearing in a pinpoint over a rise in the road. She walked back to the car, thought of getting into the back seat to lie down, but the incline of the bank and her aching leg stopped her. She gave the front of the car a shake, then a shove, to make sure it wasn't going to slide farther down into the ditch. Feeling like it was stable, Susan gingerly climbed up onto the hood and stretched out. The radiating heat of the engine felt good on her back, which had ached before and now was cramping. The clicking of the cooling engine blended with the subtle night sounds of crickets and distant frogs. Susan stared straight up into the summer night. The clouds mostly gone now. The moon still there, moving imperceptibly down the sky. A single meteorite arched across the mist of stars, shooting for the horizon, not making it. Surprisingly, another within a few seconds, then two visible at once.
Oh yeah, Dad had mentioned this.
The sky became a dazzling umbrella, a heavenly dome of falling stars. Susan tried to not blink. The shower built for several minutes, then thinned and ceased in similar time. A few stragglers signing off. A perfect, shining cover to contain a much less than perfect day. The clicking of the cooling engine continued. Then Susan realized the clicking was different in tone, deeper and uneven, coming from a few yards away.
still lying flat on the hood. She turned her head to see a deer walking unsteadily down the blacktop, past her, then into the weeds, making a smooth leap over a low wire fence, disappearing.